Hello, welcome to Why the Fork. I'm Ben Diamond, an inventor of consumer products, and thank you for listening to our quirky little podcast about humble everyday products. Today, we're looking at the toothbrush and asking, why didn't our ancestors have bad teeth? Why do I need to pay £200 for a toothbrush? And why is there toothpaste all over my sink? Because in this podcast, we look at the everyday objects in your home and ask why they look, feel, and work the way they do. We'll be talking to designers and engineers, quizzing them for the gossip on the next generation of products. And of course, there'll be a little geopolitics, social change, and possibly Napoleon. That's led us to the very clever designs we have today. This is a podcast by D2M Product Design, and I'll be talking with Phil Staunton, our design expert, and seeing him smile a little bit later. Nothing has had a bigger impact on oral care than the toothbrush. This unassuming little object that's been around for centuries has kept cavities at bay and those pearly whites bright. As a designer, it's a wonderful little object to play with, and it's a really complex challenge. You've got the very hard enamel teeth with the undulating surface and small gaps, and they're right next to this really soft gum line that you also want to clean. You want to remove both the soft, stuck-on plaque and sugars and the hard bits of food, but push too hard on the gums or the teeth and risk damaging the soft tissue that holds them all in place. And too soft, and you won't remove the bacteria, sugar and cornflakes. And mouths are different sizes, teeth are different sensitivity, and they're hard to get to, especially at the back. And it's moist, wet, dark, and you're probably in a bit of a rush. It's why there are tons of patents, designs and awards for the humble brush every year. The volume of innovation on this 20cm stick is outstanding. But it wasn't always the case. You won't believe it, but historically, our ancestors had good teeth. Their natural diets and high fibre meant that there was very little tooth decay. But I can't comment on their breath. Over 5,500 years ago, the ancient Egyptians and Babylonians used a stick to clean, and so did the Chinese as early as the Tang Dynasty, that's 2,500 years ago. Indigenous Australians, New Zealanders and Americans all had similar behaviour, which spread well into the Middle East, later establishing itself as part of the Muslim rituals. Plus, of course, the Romans and the Greeks, and through the Middle Ages in Europe. Pretty much everywhere. Now, please don't grab any old stick. Typically, these are fibrous young twigs. Arrack, which also contains natural fluoride in the East, or in Britain in the Middle Ages, willow, which was very common, and green twigs were left over from building daub and water walls, so he always looked good for the builders. You chew the end of the stick, removing the woody outer and leaving the bristle-like fibres inside. This, you work around your mouth in a similar way today, cleaning your teeth. Now, you can add salt, which acts as an abrasive, and add flavour like cumin, or urine, which does not add flavour, but acts as a cleaning agent, or cloves, which also help to numb any discomfort. And the Romans also added crushed bones like alum, seashells, eggshells, baking soda to help whiten teeth. All these abrasive ingredients were used until very recently as a part of early tooth powder, which are like dishes of powdered toothpaste. Of course, this was not perfect, and all these cultures had rudimentary dentistry, even some filling, but mainly extraction. This cleanliness was particularly important because from the Greeks to the Middle Ages, bad breath and smell was associated with spreading diseases like leprosy. But the sticks wear out, and you've got to work hard to get the outer coating off, spitting it out as you go. So somewhere around 1400, we start to see the brushes as we know it. They were used to scrub homes, they were everywhere. So the jump from using them on the floor or table to teeth is not a surprise. They were a similar size to our own. A wooden handle, sometimes bamboo, with hogs or pig's hair being used as bristles. Now this is nice and soft because we want to be able to clean the mouth gently rather than more abrasive tufts used on the floor. But we want them to be stiff, so badger hair used in shaving wouldn't be strong enough. But these hairs are hollow and trap bacteria. By 1640s, France had little brushes for making clean of the teeth, mostly covered with silver and some with a few gold and silver twists. And around the same time, diarist Samuel Pepys, then a student at Cambridge University, bought a
bundle of toothbrushes, second hand, a bargain.
Students. It wasn't the only method of cleaning. Nicholas Lemery, an apothecary to King Louis XIV of France, recommended rubbing one's teeth with powder and a rough brush, and then rinsing them with claret. The Tudors preferred to use small finger cloths. Whereas the Complete Housewife book in 1710 also advised
the too frequent use of the toothbrush makes the teeth become long and deformed, although it be a good instrument and the moderate use of it proper enough.
Our ancestors had good teeth. So why the impression we all had bad teeth? You see, something had changed. There was a new enemy on the horizon. No, not Napoleon. Sugar. Introduced to Europe around 1096, within 300 years it was being mass-produced in Lebanon, Brazil and Haiti. Everyone loved it. The Tudors consumed so much they had black teeth, or lost all of them. Elizabethans even blackening their teeth just to make it look like they were rich sugar eaters. And this is a juxtaposition. We know from the brushes and twigs that oral hygiene was well practiced. And we know that sugar couldn't have been in everyone's diets. So why do you think that all our ancestors had bad teeth and didn't brush? For this, we need to blame the Victorians. Exhuming and digging up the rich people. And the rich, in their better preserved graves, had sugar and therefore bad teeth. The Victorians were digging up the posh graves, or the very religious, who, like Thomas Becket, practice that you shouldn't wash. Nice. So these Victorians were finding the sugar eaters with no brushing and bad teeth, and made the assumption that it was all of us who didn't brush. But when you look at the paupers' graves, which had decomposed more, they still had really good teeth. Well, okay, it looks like if you can afford sugar, you have bad teeth. And although brushing will help, you will need to be brushing twice a day with toothpaste, which at the time was bones, cork, urine and clothes, so pretty ineffective for sugar. As sugar intake increased and hit the emerging middle classes as well, the brush and salt powder wasn't enough. More and more black and removed teeth. There was a huge demand for the replacement teeth, and battles, graves and the poor were a great source of dentures to add to your in-mouth collection. So now, it's Napoleon. He seems to be appearing in all of our Wider Fox stories. Yes, he brushed his teeth. No, we don't know if Josephine had black teeth. But we do know that the Battle of Waterloo and the Napoleonic Wars in general was an excellent supply of spare teeth. By 1900s, you might have had all your real teeth taken out for your 21st birthday and replaced with nicked teeth, so no need to brush. I think that as sugar increased and the availability of replacement teeth increased, the stick and the brush dropped out of favour. People did do some cleaning, but by the 1900s it became less effective and knocking them out for your 21st just the easier option. While all this was happening, the toothbrush was still developing. President Thomas Jefferson, around 1760s in the American colonies, asked a colleague in London to purchase
half a dozen toothbrushes, the hair neither too strong nor too weak, and a silver toothpick case, the smallest possible, such as you may have seen me use. They cost about a dollar.
So why this effort to get this Goldilocks brush? Like today, brushes were different sizes, and depending on the hog that supplied the hair, the bristles could either be stiffer or softer. And so for those who wanted to brush and not have replacement teeth, they needed something more standard.
Step in William Addis of Clerkenwell, London.
While spending some time at His Majesty's pleasure in Newgate Prison in 1790 for starting a riot, he had, well, bad breath. And inspired by a broom in the corner
took a bone from his dinner and crafted a brush, and became known for the first toothbrush. Now, it's not really a new invention. So why is he credited with being the inventor? Well, he saw the commercial opportunity, setting up a business to make them, using leftover materials, bones and horsehair, from his trade as a rag merchant. He built, then mass-produced, brushes. It's a true rags-to-riches story. As a stationer, he could sell the new standard brushes to the well-to-do at bookshops, which were like early coffee houses and a great place to sell innovation. His Addis business grew, and with his sons, expanded into shaving, ladies and cleaning brushes, and subcontracted for other brands. And it's still running today as Wisdom Toothbrushes, 235 years later. By standardising the brush, which you heard from President Jefferson was tricky to buy, by this relatively complex process. Oxbone, boiled and cut to length, for gents, ladies and children, and fashioned in a curved profile. Hand-drilled with bristles from Siberia to make them soften and bleach by sunlight. And with a craft industry, that's people in their houses at home, wiring in the tufts with silver wire and trimmed, packed in beautiful card boxes. It's actually similar to how we make them today, with the bristles of nylon tufted by robots. The brushes are significantly more standard than the ones that Thomas Jefferson and Samuel Pepys are using. And so by 1926, they were making almost 2 million of them. Like many of our stories, it was not the first to invent the brush, but the innovation of the design, the pack, and the channel and brand that makes the product so cool. These designs spread with mass production and the first patents in the US around 1857, 70 years later. And in 1927, his son, Robert Addis II, made the first plastic brush. And it was made from celluloid nitrate, as in movie picture film, which is incredibly flammable. In the 1920s, not everyone might have had brushes. It wasn't affordable. And there were increasing health problems driven by sugar, smoking, and frankly, just the lack of brushing. But the celluloid plastics were significantly cheaper to make. Meanwhile, the DuPont Company was busy inventing nylon. Check out its impact on why the backpack. Nylon's long chain molecules are stiff, but not too stiff, like President Jefferson's shopping list. And unlike the hog's hair, it isn't hollow. It doesn't hold bacteria, so it can also be sterilised. And hog's hair was getting hard to get hold of due to famine in Russia. In 1938, J.T. Woodside and his Wico company, having pioneered sterilised toothbrushes based on Addis's work, partnered with DuPont for an exclusive 2-year use of the nylon bristle. Named after the chair of the International Dental Association, Dr. West's Miracle Tuft was launched. This simple plastic brush with a tidy and sterile glass case promised to end animal bristle trouble forever and was a bargain at 50 cents, about $11 today. We're still using DuPont nylon bristles now. Here, Addis's and DuPont's new materials, plus the automation, means that toothbrushes are more accessible. Mass manufacture suddenly allows everyone to have a toothbrush. Even tramps, they said. And at last, we can reintroduce oral health. So in the Second World War, the US Army trained troops in brushing, and certainly in the US, this then helped educate and reintroduce oral care habits to the US after the wars.
If you brush your teeth, you'll always find you'll have all your teeth to chew and grind. You gotta brush your choppers all around, not side to side, but up and down.
Brush 'em up and brush 'em down. Keep your choppers clean and sound. Help your teeth to stay around until you're old and gray.
Oh, you had no teeth in your infancy, and you'll still have none in the infantry. If you don't take care of your teeth and gums, you'll wish you had when a toothache comes.
Brush 'em up and brush 'em down. Keep your choppers clean and sound. Help your teeth to stay around.
And there's the electric brush. First in 1937, but really around 1960, the first electric toothbrushes to hit the American market was the Broxodent from Scrip. These have rotating or oscillating heads, which are shown to clean your mouth better than manual brushes. Well, to be fair, if you use your manual brush correctly every time, you'll get the same sort of cleaning. But we're not that good at doing it right every time, which means in real life, the electric brush will always give you better performance. People are just not very good at doing the same thing accurately every day, twice a day. They have timers, which encourages you to always brush for at least 2 minutes. This gives the fluoride in your toothpaste time to bond with your teeth. It's really where design helps behaviour change. We started with the complexity of the mouth. And this is where designers really get to play. We spend hours crafting the perfect handle, shaped for comfort for different ages, stubby for kids to learn the habit to prevent overpressure, or dexterous and beautiful ones for older people. Then the bristles, cross-action, different lengths to get into the interdental spaces, like between the teeth, mixing hardness and softness to get the best results without damaging the gums. And tongue cleaning. And at all time, making them look like works of art to differentiate them from competitors. As designers, we love working on toothbrushes, like pens and cutlery, getting the perfect form that both encompasses the ergonomics and the mechanics of the in-mouth cleaning, whilst looking premium and beautiful and extruding their brand beauty. It's no wonder that Red Dot and IF Awards often feature brushes. Luna Design's Oral-B Cross-Action was one of the first groundbreaking brushes that included both soft TPU co-moulded rubber onto polypropylene handles with beautiful cross-action bristles and curved forms. It's kind of the hero product that us designers love to work on. Or step change designs such as the angled head of the Reach brush that allowed you to reach the hard to reach places at the back of your mouth. Today we're still using the humble toothbrush with that angled neck. Stay with us on Why the Fork as we explore the future of the toothbrush and wonder why we've never seen Captain James T. Kirk boldly brush his teeth in the future. Normally I end this section of Why the Fork with a bright future, but for the toothbrush, this time, it's more of a challenge. All of our work from ancient willow sticks through horsehair, grave robbing, and nylon has made the experience better and more effective. But I believe this is one product I'd love to design out. I mean, who has 2 minutes in the morning? Now go and brush your teeth. Let's talk more about the wonder of the toothbrush with our design expert, Phil Staunton from D2M. Hello, Phil.
Hi, Ben. How are you doing?
Fabulous. So my first question to you, Phil, is can you floss?
I can floss, but I hate it. And my dentist said to me, actually, that it's more important to clean between the teeth than it is to actually clean the surface of the teeth. And he recommended this water jet flosser thing. So I had one of those for a while, and then I dropped it and it broke. And I really need to do more in terms of brushing between my teeth.
Why is flossing such a pain? Like, what's it about flossing that is really difficult, I guess?
It's just the angles, and it's just awkward, and you've got your hands near your mouth and all that kind of stuff. And then I always feel it's really wasteful. I try and get away with a smaller bit of floss and then go, actually, that's really hard. And then I end up with a massive bit, and it's like, oh, great. So yeah, I think it's just a pain.
It's quite invasive as well. Like, you know, because your fingers are very close to your mouth. With the toothbrush, it's much further away. It's more delicate. Whereas flossing, it's like, I mean, it's particularly the back teeth. I can't do my back teeth. I can't. My hands are too big. My mouth is too big. Something like that. So it's quite a difficult design problem, isn't it?
It's a difficult design problem. And I tend to actually just use interdental brushes now. But again, you know, slightly concerned about the sustainability issue and the fact you're throwing quite a lot of plastic away at the end of the day. But I guess that is one of the big problems with kind of oral care design, isn't it? That a lot of the products you do end up throwing away quite frequently and then having to get new ones. So there's always that waste issue.
I think you're right.
way. What do you think we can learn from Addis's story or Thomas Jefferson's experience about choosing toothbrushes? What can we learn as designers now from that experience in the past?
Yeah, I'll take Addis, I think, because I think there's loads we can learn from him. It's fantastic, his story, and I think you told it kind of really well, and thanks for kind of sharing that. I love the idea of him sat in prison, you know, whittling away with a piece of bone, sticking some bristles from a broom in the corner through to kind of, you know, brush his teeth. I think the big thing is, you know, he's kind of often cited as the inventor of the toothbrush, but actually it was invented, you know, 1,000 years before in China. But what he did invent really was the toothbrush business, and he really worked out how to get it to market as well, you know, through his kind of stationer's business, and then also the fact he used kind of cottage industry and people in their homes, you know, kind of like winding wire around to kind of hold the bristles in and all that kind of stuff. I think it's just a fantastic story. But the big thing to learn, I think, is timing. He got his timing absolutely right. You know, it was just as sugar was a real problem and was actually now affordable by a lot more people. So a lot more people were having kind of issues in terms of their teeth. So, you know, he really kind of nailed it on that front, as well as I say, you know, the other critical elements of a business. And that cottage industry element really allowed him to scale it really quickly. And actually, considering, you know, we're talking hundreds of years ago, you know, he managed to be selling millions of toothbrushes really quite fast. I think he had an incredible kind of business acumen and plenty of time while sat in jail to work all this out, I guess.
That's definitely true. I know all my best inventions happen not when I'm in the office or in the lab. They happen when I'm on my bike or in the shower, when your brain is contemplating and thinking, making those connections. And I think as designers, you need to have that pontification, that kind of to do it as well. So yeah. So guys, I do not recommend going to jail inventing, but definitely spending your time looking at things in the corner.
Yeah, and I do often wonder though, if I'd started to riot and ended up in jail, what might have I invented by now? You know,
all the best inventions start with riots. That's a good sign, I think. Yeah. How would you design for oral care? So we've mentioned the mouth's quite difficult, but you know, how do you test a toothbrush? How do you have rows of volunteers? Like, what's the process that you go through to kind of come up with something new for fit in the mouth?
Yeah, and it's a really good question. So I think in terms of the way we would approach it as D2M product design is we'd start quite small. So it would be, we're going to build some 3D models. We're going to test in terms of the ergonomics, particularly around kind of hand shape and being able to hold it and maneuver the brush and things, because that's quite easy. Mm. You can print it in standard materials and kind of get on and test that relatively easily. And hands don't vary that much. When we get into the mouth bit, which is the hard bit, then again, we would start by testing out on our team. And because we've got, you know, a nice team that's quite varied, so to speak, in terms of different ages and different sexes and stuff, you know, we get so far with that, and that's quite cost effective, obviously. But beyond that, then, you know, you're into user groups, you know, and testing on a wider variety of people. Including, you know, thinking about kind of different ethnic backgrounds that might have different mouth shapes and all that kind of other stuff. And actually, if you do it really properly, you're going to spend way more on market research, testing and focus groups than you are on product development or probably even tooling. Yeah. Because, yeah, that is absolutely critical, really, if you're going to do a really good job and make it really work for a lot of different people.
I bet, listeners, if you run your tongue around your mouth now, I bet even though you've brushed your teeth really well this morning, you'll feel some bits that aren't quite so good. Why is it so difficult to get that consistent cleaning for yourself, let alone, you know, when you're testing and designing a new toothbrush?
Yeah, there's a few things. I think, you know, one is, and this relates to why kids really don't like brushing either, is that, you know, there's no immediate reward. So it's not like there's any visual indication or any kind of, you know, audible kind of result or anything from cleaning your teeth properly or not. Yeah. And in fact, you know, you can clean your teeth badly probably for many years before you really start to get kind of serious kind of pain and issues and everything else. So I think because it's invisible, you know, what you're doing, because there's no kind of immediate pain or benefit, then, you know, that just means that it's viewed as a chore. We don't really want to do it, and we don't really do it properly kind of as a result. And I think, you know, particularly with kids, you know, as parents, we've all battled to try and get our kids to clean their teeth. And, you know, no, they just hate doing it, right? And there's various reasons around that. It's unpleasant for a child from a sensory perspective. I think often if parents start by cleaning the children's teeth, you know, they can't feel when they're kind of hitting the back of their mouth or anything else. So inevitably, it's going to be painful. And also the child has to stand still, right, for 2 minutes in front of a mirror. And who wants to do that?
And once again in our story, we have our regularly featured guest, Napoleon Bonaparte, showing up, this time invading countries and not brushing his teeth.
He did brush his teeth, by the way. He had a silver-handled toothbrush. He was very pedantic about personal care. And in the Napoleon Museum, there is his toothbrush that he allegedly
used. You're kidding.
Used.
This is fantastic.
From my research, anyway.
But and his troops, so both the British and the French, also brushed their teeth, and it was part of their uniform to have them within their bags as well. So we know that oral care was incredibly important to them. But you were telling me earlier that something else happened on the battlefield.
Yeah, so basically the victors would often obviously loot the corpses of the soldiers that had been killed. But often one thing they would do is pull out the teeth, because you could then, there was quite a market, as you said in your story, for teeth and for having someone else's teeth put in to your mouth. And so, you know, after the battle, lots of soldiers and soldiers' wives, in fact, you know, went round pulling out all the teeth, and they ended up with these little bags of teeth that then they then take home and sell to whoever was then responsible for putting into other people's mouths.
And I love that the Napoleon equivalent of eBay is basically full of different teeth of different sizes. You can imagine, like, the, you know, how difficult it is to shop on Amazon and find exactly what you want. You're trying to find, like, a tooth to fit into your back of your mouth based off, is it a French tooth? Is it a British tooth? Has it been nicked out of a grave? I think it's thank goodness for better oral care today.
Yeah, and also thank goodness for the Napoleonic Wars, because yeah, actually you had all these British soldiers with the added toothbrush as part of their kit, then going throughout Europe as a kind of basically free marketing for William Addis for his toothbrush, and it then spread throughout Europe.
And this is fascinating, because that's both Napoleonic Wars, when effectively the British were spreading brushing, but we also saw that again in the Second World War with the American troops being encouraged to brush, and they had to have wooden brushes, not the plastic ones, because the soldiers were terrified of it being flammable. Never a good idea to set fire to your mouth. That encouraged and changed behaviour back into the US as troops returned and oral care then habits then became part of everyday life. But also, toothbrush factories were a really good place to hide aircraft. And
really?
Addis's factories weren't just making toothbrushes for the troops. They were hiding aircraft in specially built bunkers so that, you know, the Germans couldn't find them. So, you know, when you brush your teeth, remember you're helping the war effort, I think is probably the message we want to leave everyone with. So now, talking about the future of toothbrushes with us is Simon Enever, who set up and founded Quip. Simon, hello, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to see you. Yeah, I'm an industrial designer and educated in the UK, born and educated in the UK, went to Loughborough University, came over to New York straight from school and was a design consultant for 4 or 5 years, and then happened to go to a fateful dental visit back in 2012 and left that visit with this idea to create an oral care startup, and it became called Quip. And you know, spent a decade running Quip in the US, learning everything you can about toothbrushes and oral care. And now I run a venture studio where we're looking to build a next generation of startups with industrial design and design at the heart of everything.
Tell us about this fateful dental visit. I have this vision of you in some kind of torture chamber, lying back, like the prison that Addis was in, and kind of going, there must be a better way. Why start an oral care company, and what were the big challenges in creating a new toothbrush?
Yeah, it was exactly how you imagined the experience. I was led back. I mean, honestly, there's a funny UK-US story within there, which was that I thought it was going to be your usual 4-minute UK cleaning, and it was a 45-minute US cleaning. So I was led back open mouth for 45 minutes. And honestly, the dentist was just ranting about the industry. There's a lot to it, but the summary was, you know, oral care is so important, quite simple to do, but most people just don't bother with the basics. And he kind of, you know, I was digging into why I'm a designer, you know, I'm always poking questions at people as to why that would be the case. And his headline was, you know, people will not stick to or change bad habits or stick to good habits if they just don't like the thing that they're doing. And people dislike brushing their teeth, they hate flossing, and they have phobias of going to the dentist. And he's like, until that changes, doesn't matter how many modes you have on a toothbrush, you're not going to really change those bad habits as you go. And so I kind of left that dental visit thinking, this is a design problem. This is kind of exactly what we're tasked with as designers, is changing habits through products, services, and solutions that people want to pick up, want to use, you know, want to use differently. And that was kind of the origin of Quip.
It just came out of that dentist,
yeah,
kind of,
yeah,
45-minute rant where you could say nothing much because...
I was just sat there genuinely soaking it all in, you know, yeah.
How hard is it to change someone's behaviour, particularly, you know, with the challenge of going from something people really don't want to do to getting it to something that people really enjoy doing? And why, as designers, do we feel it's our responsibility to kind of make that change?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the hardest things possible. As going through that journey, we learned that I think it's by 7 years old, you've formed most of your habits, especially sticky ones, you know, things like brushing your teeth.
Picking your nose, that's something, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And once they're formed, it's really, really difficult to change back. And so I guess our insight was that companies had been trying the feature version of how to solve that, you know, like different modes, different feelings, different whatever. But no one had really taken the approach of the other people were taking in other industries, you know, in the cosmetic space, in shaving, of just creating something that people liked. You know, they wanted to talk about, they wanted to, in our case, put on their mirror and have out, you know. And so we just took a very, I don't love using the word lifestyle, but kind of definitely consumer focused approach, and like really spoke to people like, why do you hate this? Oh, it's the wires. It's the, you know, it's the bulky, it's the noise.
The
it's waking the kid up. Yeah. The muck.
Yeah.
It's, it, exactly. And, you know, so I think the attempts out there were just missing maybe the point of what why people weren't wanting to brush their teeth.
Do you think some of it was because you're coming from a fresh idea? So, you know, you didn't come from an Orca company. You weren't working for the big consumer companies. You came from a, you know, pure industrial design, beauty, form, engineering perspective. Is that fresh eyes really important when you're looking at these sort of problems?
I think completely. I think that was the entire reason that we were able to disrupt the industry. You know, everyone told me, initially, you know, dentist we met, investor we pitched, you know, was like, what are you doing? You know, there's 3-4 giant global companies in this space, running this space. There's no chance with all the money in the world that you're going to disrupt it. And we just had this, like, it was somewhat initially a gut feeling. We're like, yeah, but no one's doing the thing that the consumer's asking. You know, clearly no one is speaking to people in a open, you know, going into their their bathrooms way. And I guess, yeah, you know, we just, our insights were so different to what was coming onto the market. And we just kept thinking like, well, we're hearing what people are saying that they don't like about what's out there. So we pushed forward.
I definitely noticed when working in oral care that there wasn't the consideration for the beauty in the bathroom. You weren't making products that were designed primarily as something which you treasure in, you know, in your home, like you would do in, say, kitchen appliances. They were being designed from a functional perspective. And I think what you've been able to do with the company is create a beautiful product. And I wonder how important is the aesthetics alone, or the kind of the humor-centered functionality alone, the bit that makes a difference when a design of a product like a toothbrush?
I mean, for us, it was almost one of those things where we were embarrassed to say, when we were developing it, particularly, we were talking to dentists in the industry, we were almost embarrassed to linger on the aesthetics because it's a serious industry. It's a health problem. It's a health product. And then we'd show them the product and they'd be like, that's important. And they would be the ones saying like, that is the key. That is the key thing, because they got it. They're like, the story that you guys made, you know, it touches on a lot of this, like anything. Yeah. Dentists just want you to pick up a brush. And again, to the point even of electric toothbrush versus manual, it's really about getting you to want to use it, enjoy using it a bit better. So anything that gets you just to pick it up, use it for 2 minutes twice a day and so on, was huge. So it was everything in the end, you know, like we basically ended up picking the features the simple features dentists were saying were must-haves, the timer, ultimately now, you know, pressure sensors and so on, but the timer, some sort of movement to get the bristles into your gum line. Ultimately, the aesthetic was the big win. You know, it was the reason when we spoke to our consumers, when we said, why are you now brushing more often? They were like, because I like the product, you know? I like it.
It makes me feel good. It looks good. And I was just thinking, like, preparing for this, I actually grabbed some brushes to show in the videos here, and I realized they were really filthy and I had to get the nail brush out to scrub them. I honestly can't think of the last time I cleaned my electric brushes, you know, but the car, you know, it went to a car wash the other day because it was a bit dirty. And you're right, we don't have the reverence perhaps in these brushes that we do with, say, some of our other products. So that must make it even more challenging to design them and engineer them.
Oh yeah. There's very different standards I think we all have about different products. And I think it comes to what we're willing to invest in them as well. People will happily invest hundreds of dollars even now on let's say cosmetics that might last a month. You know, you've got this toothbrush thing, which is driving whether or not you need a 3,000 pound or dollar root canal in 20 years, and you're very unwilling to spend more than $5 or £5, you know, on a toothbrush. So it sits in a very challenging space in people's minds.
And I'm curious as to what Phil and Simon, what you think the future of toothbrushes might be like. What's the laser for mouthwashers, guys? What's the kind of the technology jump that we're looking for, or the consumer experience jump that we're looking for? And, you know, how do we kind of bring it up in the value that we see, say, in vacuum cleaners or IPL laser for, you know, skincare and stuff like that?
Yeah, I'd love to see something that is just really quick. It's not actually a lot of time, 2 minutes morning, 2 minutes night, you know, that type of thing. But people still feel it's ages. And certainly, you know, as a dad of three teenage boys, I'm lucky if I get them to clean their teeth for 20 seconds. And yeah, I just love something that would brush your teeth, get in between them, like floss does, do whatever's necessary in terms of tongue cleaning that I don't even understand properly, and like do the whole lot in like 15 seconds for me and I'm done. You know, that would be perfect. That's what I'd love to see the future as.
Yeah, I agree. And I know people are trying it. You know, there's examples out there of the attempt. I think literally one might have been called the 50-second toothbrush at some point. I do think that's the aim, you know, kind of brushing them all at the same time, essentially. And we're not quite there yet, clearly, when it comes to the match of the technology and the price point to that goal. But that's got to be the aim. I think it's there's no reason why you can't brush all your teeth at the same time, which is how you get, I think, down to that 10-second mark. But you've got to do it well. And I think that's a big leap, and oddly complicated, mostly because we all have completely unique mouths. You know, how do you measure like the gum line? It's all about getting in the gum line, you know. So how do you get in and make sure that every individual's gum line is precisely mapped in order to be properly cleaned? And, you know, we're talking about things that are possible. Just putting it in a device that doesn't cost, you know, $1,000 and feel weird in your mouth is probably where the problem lies.
And that's really the heart of the challenge, isn't it? That every mouth is different. And, you know, and obviously when you clean your teeth, you might have just eaten, or you might have just had orange juice or sugar. The actual experience is very hard. And we are beginning to see that sort of work, though. So if we think about like the braces that are molded to your teeth and that the individual piece of work, but then you're talking, you know, £4,000 for treatment to kind of bring yourself in. And I think this goes back perhaps to the level of investment you're willing to make. If you were willing to spend £4,000 on a bespoke system that would do your teeth every time, then maybe those technologies would become viable for us as a design and engineering guys.
Yeah, and I think the technology is probably getting there. You know, 3D scanners and stuff are improving all the time. Obviously, kind of 3D printing, you can 3D print in kind of, you know, medical grade materials now that are safe to put in the mouth, safe to actually put in the body kind of permanently. Some of the key technical requirements are getting there. And I suspect there is a market actually for some people who are prepared to spend £4,000 on something that basically they have for the rest of their adult life that is going to save them that time every day and guarantee, in inverted commas, that, you know, their teeth are brushed really well and they don't have those expensive dental bills. It may be that the business model around that as a lease model, so maybe you're paying £10 a month for it for the next kind of 40 years or, you know, whatever it is, it needs to develop so that actually you don't have that kind of upfront cost to kind of get the volume there. But I suspect at the moment, to have a device that's personalised to you that will clean your teeth that well, we're probably not talking £4,000, you're probably talking £40,000. So I think that's probably the challenge, is going from a device that's that kind of money to something that actually you could, through a system, get to a point where actually it is then affordable. In inverted commas.
I am hoping someone's listening to this and kind of sketching something quickly now that's going to solve all our problems. One question then about toothpaste. So it's always frustrated me that toothpaste and toothbrushes are separate. Is that a technical reason? You know, is it the goo inside that you can't squeeze out? Is it a chemical reason? Is it a business reason? You know, are the big companies kind of protective of it? Or is it habitual? Like, why is this such a complex problem?
I feel like that the toothbrush with the toothpaste inside is every industrial designer's first design idea at school. I think I sketched one. I remember it being a thing back at the time of the concept. I'm sure Phil does as well. But my take
is hard. Squeezing it out is hard. Yeah.
My take is it is all the things you said. Sorry to be the cop-out answer, but I think it's both the physical difficulty of having that liquid part in it. You know, really, you're talking a consumer electronic product, you know, not just a, let's say, manual toothbrush. I think all of that is very difficult. Toothpaste goes off, it hardens. you're just bringing risk that a product that already is high risk to break because of the environment it's in, you're making it even more difficult to, also even higher risk than it could break. I would also bring business model in. You know, there's some very big, powerful companies that run toothpaste. I think that there's absolutely business and business model reasons and just brand reasons that that's not happened as well.
I think it's also consumer choice, right? So people are their favorite brand of toothpaste. So if you suddenly come out with a toothbrush that's got the toothpaste built in as a capsule, you've actually suddenly got to have like 8 different SKUs so that you've got the Colgate one and this one and the Aquafresh and all this kind of other stuff. Yeah. And you've got to do deals with those big companies that they're going to supply you so that you can put them into the toothbrush in the first place. And they're not easy companies to get in and deal with in any way. So, yeah, there's some real challenges there to anyone who kind of wants to try and achieve that from a commercial perspective.
Would you guys then think Captain Kirk would be using in the future? You know, we never see him brushing his teeth in Star Trek, and I'm always intrigued. Are people still going to be brushing? Is it going to be an evolution like the sonic brushes, or is it going to be plasma or the water swimmers? Or is it going to be, you know, feel sort of in mouth, mouth guard, total thing? Like, what do we think that future looks like?
Look, I think the first question is, do we all have teeth? Because I feel like there's a trend of people having fake teeth, which I hope doesn't go
not
too
again
far.
Not again. That happened, you know, before, when the sugar came about. I hope we got rid of that. So exactly. Yeah, real teeth is better.
Let's assume we have real teeth. I think it is a version of an all-in-one, you know, in-mouth thing. I do think that to your point, Ben, that it ultimately will then have to and combine liquid and physical brushing, but I think you're going to be putting some sort of a ultra slim mouth guard type thing in your mouth, pressing a button, and it's going to be kind of like a car wash, or a water flosser mixed with toothbrush, mixed with car wash, mixed with mouthwash, mixed with toothpaste, all in one. There's things out there that's starting to do those elements. Again, price point, comfort, customization. That's the tougher part. And then we're clearly not quite there yet. But I don't think we're too. I don't think we're as far away as we might feel right now.
I think I'd add to that. I think it's probably going to be supplied by Captain Kirk's doctor/dentist. I've no idea what they're called. Bones, is that right?
Dr. McCoy, yeah. Dr. McCoy's mouth gloss, it will be.
Yeah, so I think it will be leased from Dr. McCoy to his patient. And I think it's probably got a lot of AI stuff built in it as well that is scanning the teeth, that is going, you've got a cavity forming here, so you can get that preventative action in really soon. And I think it's probably actually a pretty expensive device, but that is linked to your overall oral healthcare, and you are prepared to pay a monthly subscription for, because it's preventing larger medical bills kind of, you know, further down the line, is what I suspect.
I love that. The leasing, the Netflix subscription for your mouth, and that's awesome. Simon and Phil, thank you so much for answering our questions today on the future of the toothbrush. And thank you for listening to Why the Fork. Thanks to you, we're a top 10% of all podcasts, which is amazing for a little chatty podcast about the design of everyday objects in your home and office. We really appreciate it. But please do keep liking, subscribing and downloading it. And please tell your friends, your family, and even your dentist. And join us on our next episode of Why the Fork.